needs to be really like right on,
otherwise right on. All right.
Otherwise they'll raid the hands and they'll say we can't hear.
Treat it like an ice cream.
Exactly.
I'll shift forward. Firstly, I would like to thank Sandhya and Odelia very much for the very kind invitation to come and a bit more volume. Or switch. If you can hear, can you hear okay? So I just said that I'd like to thank Sandhya and Odelia for kindly inviting me to come across and meet with you and talk with you and also make some time for some questions as well. It's a genuine privilege and honor to be here and to share a little bit with you. And in the exploration with you this evening, what I would like to touch upon for a little while is the important and significant relationship between inspiration and insight. Sometimes when you and I, as women and men on this earth, we take a look at ourselves and we take a look at each other, and there is a recognition in the perception of the quite remarkable and exceptional potential we have as human beings existing on this earth to generate out of our being something deep, something profound, creative, and potential to make an extraordinary and remarkable contribution to life. And there are moments in your life and in my life where we take a small but significant step out of the conventions, out of everyday climate that you and I live in, the working climate, the study climate, the parenting, the relationship world, the social world, the city, the town and the village. And such as being here, it provides the opportunity to step out of the known and familiar, which is very important to do from time to time, to kind of check in with ourselves. What is the condition? What is the current state, shall we say, of the inner life? Where are we at this point in our life? And these processes called mindfulness, called meditation, called awareness, called inquiry is essentially respecting our potential to touch upon something deep, to listen inwardly. So the mindfulness and the meditations are never intended as some kind of end in itself, but as a contribution in the silences, in the stillnesses, to touch the deep. And it's the deep where the precious and the meaningful abide. And you and I know, we know from our experience, how tragically easy it is, in the persistence of the daily continuities, to live rather superficially, in which all that we talk about is success and failure and pleasure and pain and chat, chat, chat. And to live a way of life in which habit, the sheer routine and habit of the daily existence, seems to move our life along. It seems like rather than that consciousness of the active engagement and the creative, the life gets moved along by the current of circumstances, by the pressures from others, by the pressures that we place upon ourselves. And it's something rather sad, really. It's rather disappointing, really. And our kind of short moments in life in which there's the opportunity for a little waking up of the being there may provide some access to something deep. And sometimes with the life and with the meditations and with the mindfulnesses, and I know for a number of you it might be the first time in such a social environment, it can be quite hard to know the relationship between meditation, mindfulness and the deep. And to give you a small example of what I mean, I remember some years ago, and it's one of many which I could relate to you, where one of the participants on the retreat, she had participated in a number of retreats, and she said to me, "Christopher, you know," she said, "I hear all of these good meditation instructions about mindfulness of breathing and stillness of the body and being conscious and connecting with the breath and much, much else." And she said, "So far, I don't think on a retreat yet, despite many hours of sitting, I've yet to find my nose, let alone my breath there." And then she made a rather interesting statement. She said, "Somewhere inside of me, though I just can't meditate, I just can't do it." She said, "I don't think I've been able to observe in several retreats two consecutive breaths." She says, "I am the world's worst meditator." Some of you may be having this view today. And then she said, "But Christopher, you know what?" She said, "I've always lived in my home country. I've never travelled. I've always been afraid of travelling." And she said, "Guess what? I've just come back from 6 weeks in China. I went alone. I came back." And she says, "There's something inside of me which tells me my role as the world's worst meditator got me to China." She said, "I know there is a connection. I don't know what it is, but there is a connection." And sometimes in conscious life, in the consciousness there, despite "I can't find my nose, I can't find my breath, I don't know if I'm breathing in and out," and the most popular mantra of the meditator, it's got five words to it, "What am I doing here?" This one, it's far more successful than "Om Mani Padme Hum," by the way. And even though the mantra is going through the day with a number of people, sometimes it might be vague, it might not even be known, in the quietness and in the quiet support and the much love and the kindness of the good teachers here and the climate and culture, something else is going on. Something else is having some chance to, as it were, metaphorically, breathe a little. Something else is happening. So though my consciousness might be, "Oh, I'm with the breath, but I've got a lot of stress. I'm with the breath, but I'm thinking too much. I'm with the breath, but this is the most boring experience since the last Hollywood film I went to see, or whatever it might be. And in spite of that, and in spite of the views, when a human being is resting just for short periods and a little silence and a little quietude and in some endurance, you know, the pains in the knees, the back aches, the boredom, etc., takes a little trust that something else can be occurring there which may at some point touch us. It may get us to China. We don't know what our China is, but it may get us, contribute to getting us there. Just just 2 or 3 months ago, I had a very kind invitation to go to Thailand. And I had some relationship with the East, having, as a young guy, spent 10 years there and these years as a Buddhist monk. And my old teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa, Ajahn means teacher, Buddha, and Dasa, servant of the Buddha. And he lived for more than 65 years in the forest. And passed away quite some years ago, and Thailand was celebrating his 111th, 111 since his birth there. And the 111 is significant with Thailand. And I remember there, and one of the monks who I knew quite well in the forest, this is a true story, quite well in the forest, he went, I also, if I may say a small thing, went to the cave. My period in the cave was less than a year. This particular monk went to the cave with a vow to be 20 years in the cave and not see or speak to anybody. He's a mildly eccentric monk, but there are a few around there. So the lay persons in the village near the cave in the hills would take the food, and because of the animals around, would hang it from a branch in the bowl. He would then in the morning go to that tree, collect the food, come back and eat and continue with his meditation practice. This is how he lived. And the years went by. When he'd come to around 19 and a half years of his 20-year vow there, he got, I don't know what the Hebrew word, because I don't know any Hebrew, he got piles. You know, there's something with problematic with the backside. It's called piles. I don't know. Anyway, he got pain.
Hemorrhoid?
Yes. Taurine. Exactly. Precisely. What's the word? Taurine. Sounds nicer in Hebrew. So we got Torim there. And he needed treatment. And it was so painful, he couldn't get to the tree to collect the food there. So the villager who was bringing the food for that week knew and came to see what was the matter. And he said he had hemorrhoid. They needed some treatment. And so wisely, he completed his 19 and a half years, he completed, and got the treatment. He came back to the forest monastery, where I was as a monk in that same monastery. So the monks, we were extremely curious. I mean, 19 and a half years, no speaking, in silence, in a cave, not seeing anybody. What's the question? What is your experience? What was it like being in that situation voluntarily for 19 and a half years? His response sent a shockwave through all of us. He said, it was a complete waste of time. And the monk went, what? Like that. He said, I realized life is about relationship. monk went, whoa, sadhu, well said, well said. Life is about relationship. And sometimes in life, the voice of the deep comes unexpectedly. And with all the years, and of course many other stories that he related to us, but in all the years, sometimes something comes from the deep. It makes something crystal clear there. And the interest and the awareness and the concentration and the curiosity in the other monks, the nuns, the people, the visitors, you can imagine, he was so interested in us and interested in life and interested in people. Oh, do we have to go to the cave for that? Isn't that with us every day? Are we going to live our life just kind of taking each other for granted? Are we going to explore and allow something deep to touch, to have a deep relationship with ourselves and contribute to a deep relationship with others because we're really interested? And that interest in the other, there's a lovely English word for it. That interest in the other is called love. Life is about love. And there's that lovely, lovely sweetheart, Persian poet, Rumi, says to us the best known line of all of his lovely poetry, who he is by far the biggest selling poet in Europe, born in, I think, 13th century, and his poems have touched the heart, and the most famous one line of them all is, there are 100 ways to kiss the earth. Oh, you and I, we could meditate on that for the rest of our life. It wouldn't be a wasted moment. There are 100 ways to love. There are 100 ways to give. There are 100 ways to share. And therefore, our inquiry, our meditation, our exploration to touch the deep has one purpose, to release the love. That releasing of the love in these teachings is called liberation. That's what liberation is about. It's the release of the love. And there's something precious and freeing about it. Sometimes, in our exploration with life, in our engagement, and sometimes you and I hear the languages. I have one or two examples here that I want to share with you. We can hear a lot about connection, and genuinely, connection is important. And as I said, relating or connecting with other people. In the sheer diversity of connections, human beings can often, shall we say, see, this is important here, see the presentation of the other, what emerges from the other as an identity, there, and that can affect our communication with the other, whoever it might be. And sometimes it's extremely difficult to hide. I regularly take the train from London to Paris, Brussels, Germany, or whatever, to offer teachings. And incidentally, on that, you know, our children, the kids that we have contact with are just precious with their imagination. And my grandson, a year or two ago, he's about 7 or 8, he said to me, "Oh, Granddad, how do you get to Germany?" And I say, "Oh, I take the train, and then the train goes under what we call the English Channel, there through the tunnel, and then he gets into France, and I get to Brussels, I change trains in Brussels, and I go to Cologne or Dusseldorf or wherever. And my grandson said with his big Anglo-Caribbean eyes, because he's Anglo-Caribbean, he says, "Granddad, can you see the fish when you're in the tunnel?" And I thought to myself, if we can, shit, we're in trouble. I said, no, we can't. And sometimes in that making, shall we say, of the journey, and in the passage of the movement that we take place, sometimes we meet with people. Sometimes I'm on the train. I mean, I'm not dressed like this. Not too often. Anyway, on the train, I'm wearing a pair of trousers. I've got some black shoes on. You know, a shirt. You know, a jacket or whatever. And the ticket collector is walking down, and nearly all French and German citizens. And as soon as he sees me, he switches to English. And I think, how does he know? My eyes are above my nose, like everybody else. My mouth is beneath my nose. My ears are stuck on the side of their head. Why? How does he know? So sometimes there's something about us. And as my friends say, "Christopher, you're so English." Apart from when you have a hat on and look a little bit like Leonard Cohen, which I think is a very nice compliment, I have to say. So sometimes there is the presentation. There is the present. To go deeper is inner and outer. Here we're, of course, concentrating on going a little bit deeper. That means sometimes getting behind some of our roles and identity, the identity of the worker, the identity of the student, the identity of the mother and the father, the identity of the son and the daughter, the identity of the lover, the partner, the husband, the wife, or whatever. These are natural presentations of the human being, as well as the identity, of course, of the religion or of the nation state and many, many others. And these are presentations of the human being. And with those presentations there, we want to see what is in the deep of the being, what informs the presentation. Do you understand? You have your roles, I have my roles. While we are here, we might have some thought and some feeling. What's coming from the deep of the being, which is affecting and contributing some influence to the perception, to the view? And that listening and that alertness within is not only to understand that and to see that movement, but equally, is it possible for me as a human being to get behind the role of the other, to see the other as a human being just like myself, with whom I can talk, with whom I can communicate with love? And the identity of the human being is not, or the role is not so important. The going deep is to see deeper than that. I mean, this is a slightly out of the box example, whatever. One of the women on the retreat, she said to me, not unusual story, "Christopher, you can't imagine how much problem my mother gives me." This is another mantra. And sometimes, fathers too, you know, it goes both ways. So in this case, sometimes my mother is ringing me up now. And one of the refrains that will come out will be, "Do you realize how much I have sacrificed for you?" Gosh, please. Is a mother going... Is the daughter on the other end of the phone going to fall on her knees with overwhelming gratitude when she's being told three times a day how much the mother or the father has given up for her? So she said, it goes on. And it's a little bit harder in Israel. You know, it's a small country. It's not easy to get away from them, etc. You know, my prayers are with you. No wonder that plane, those Air Berlin flights are so absolutely packed out to Berlin. You're not going to Berlin, you're getting away from. All right, it's easy here. So sometimes there is the role. So with the good woman speaking to me, she said, it's like this for years, this pressure and this fault-finding and this putting me down from the parent that really makes life difficult. So in a kind of off-the-cuff moment, I said to her, look, if it's as you say, and you're not exaggerating, and it really is like this, my suggestion is very simple. Find a new mother. If the old one's not working, look for a new one. There. He said, what do you mean, Christopher? What do you mean? I said, honestly, that's what I mean when I say, find a new mother. There. A few weeks later, quite unexpectedly, I didn't say any more, I just left it like that. Don't be anxious, the mother's in the room here, hang in. And a few weeks later, she emailed me. And she said, this woman, lovely, very beautiful woman in her early mid-30s, she emailed me a few weeks later and she said, Christopher, I've just found a new mother there. And she said, there is a woman in my office who's in her mid-50s, who I really get on with. I can share what I'm going through and my relationships and my friendships, and I can really talk with her, and she really, really listens to me. And she said, one day I said to her, would you be my mother? Like that. And the woman, the manager in the office, said, I would love to be your mother. And she said, the change which has come about now, that when my biological mother telephones me, and she said she hasn't changed there, now I don't react anymore. I don't find myself slamming the phone down. I don't find myself arguing anymore. I listen to her with much more kindness. The reactivity seems to have gone. I just talk to her as a person, and I see she's struggling, and she's some of it's landing on top of me, etc. And I just feel much more considerate towards. So the message is, if you're struggling with mummy and daddy, have a look around. Your new mummy and daddy might be in the hall here. Don't look at me. All right, teasing here. Okay. So sometimes in the freshness of the being there, and sometimes their willingness in life to kind of, in the deep of the being, look and listen to the deeper voice. That willingness, which can provide us with inspiration and some insight, but it's not easy. And one of the reasons it's not easy, because often, as you and I know, there is not a single voice. It would be much easier if I just go deep, and then a single voice is kind of coming through and in telling me what to do, or what's the best thing to do, or the wise or the loving thing to do. But the inner life is a little bit more complicated. And so sometimes we have contrasting voices. And one voice says, well, you should do this. And then the other voice says, no, it's too early, it's not the right time, I'm not ready, or whatever. And another voice says, oh, maybe I do something else. And then you make the terrible mistake of looking for advice from your friends. And then your friends come out with this merciless unforgiving one-liner which says to you, if I were you, I would, but you're not me. And so then the person with good intention, your so-called friend, who says to you, you should do this. So before you had two or three voices, now you've got four, etc. What voice do we listen to? What do we listen to inside of ourselves? Sometimes the dilemma is a common one. Shall I stay or shall I go? Whew. How many of us have been through that one? Shall I stay with him or her, or shall I go? Shall I stay in this job or shall I go? Shall I stay in these studies? Shall I go? Shall I carry on traveling or shall I not go traveling? Shall I continue living what I just heard from the other group in that village called Tel Aviv, or should I go? I go and live somewhere else. And these voices of one or the other. So from a spiritual perspective here, from a spiritual perspective, the first important consideration is the ethic. Is the ethic present? Therefore, the ethic is neither to harm nor exploit. That's the ethic. And many times, the choices that you and I have actually have nothing to do with it. There's nothing unethical about it. If it is an ethical issue, from a spiritual standpoint, there is no choice. One must be dedicated to the ethic. If the ethic is non-violence, if the ethic is non-exploitation, if the ethic is non-corruption, if the ethic is kindness, there, not easy, but it's to stay true to the ethic, to really stay true to it. That's the deep voice to stay with. But as I say, there are plenty of times with our voice, there's nothing ethical about it, it's a matter of choice. And the difficulty, when we look deep, and there is some uncertainty and some doubt and insecurity, and we need some insight or some inspiration, sometimes in the movement that's going on, internally, we don't choose it, of course, there is a struggle. And the struggle about doing this, this, or that. From a mindfulness meditation view and perspective, it is an indication that at the moment there is too much movement in the deep of the being. And the being is moving, it's shifting, it's vibrating, something's going on, and it sends up waves or ripples through to the surface, through to, so to speak, you and me. And when it arrives there, it can arrive there with certain thoughts. So the thoughts may be yes to this, no to that, I don't know. So part of the process here, never an easy one, can I find enough steadiness in the being there, in the quiet moments of the day, here and at home and elsewhere, to feel a certain steadiness there, which actually reduces the choices. It actually gives more opportunity from the deep for a single, healthy, wise, and caring, empathetic voice to come through. So our moments of some calmness in our life and some stillness, sometimes it comes quite naturally and spontaneously, and sometimes it comes with practice. But we want to be quietly still, quietly mindful, quietly present. And in that quietness of the present, things can settle down. We are still listening inwardly to the deep, and perhaps out of that, a single, insightful, creative or adventurous voice can arise. My daughter, who's also my kind of best friend, she's in the mid-30s, single mum, four kids, and the kids age from 2 to 16. She's adventurous. Three different fathers, you know, she's adventurous. And she does amazing work in the city, working with the migrants and the refugees and the asylum seekers and problematic households, etc. So it's a pretty full life. And in terms of meditation, her one-liner to me is, "Ah, Dad, you do your thing, I'll do mine, and we respect each other for that. We won't have any argument, and there won't be any pressure from you." So this has been the agreement, like 36 years of this there. She sent me a text. She's sitting on the underground zoo, that means the morning tube in London. I call it the underground zoo. And she's traveling along, and she texts me. She said, "Dad, I'm thinking so much about everything that I've got to do today. It's just, I'm on the train, it's 8:30 in the morning, all I'm thinking about, all these things I've got to do and organize with all these people that I've got to meet." And then she said, "I just remembered." She said, "For the first time in my life," she said, "I sat up straight, I closed my eyes, and I just started being mindful of breathing in and breathing out and relaxing." And she said, she texted me, and at the very end she said, "Dad, guess what? It works!" To which I said, like Leonard Cohen would say, "Hallelujah, you know, Inshallah, whatever." So sometimes in life, it's the small moment which is the turning point. It's a small moment that says, "Wow, there's some potential here. Wow, there's some inspiration here." And she's even saying, "I've even had a thought, if I can farm out the kids, to come on a retreat with you." Whoa, this is something. So from the small moment of life there, those small moments come from something deep. They shed light on something. They create a new idea, a new potential. And we know it's authentic when we respond to it. That's the critical thing. So if an inspiration comes to you from the deep, an insight comes to you from the deep, the only way in practical terms that we know is because we respond to it. If there is no response, it's neither inspirational nor is it an insight. It's just a bloody good idea which is going to waste. So that movement of the intellect, that inspiration, that insight, the confirmation of it is some actualization. That's how we know. And we have a deep interest in the exploration, sometimes listening to the deep inner voices, and sometimes the inner voice which we experience, a common one as well, is that the voice sometimes with each other can be, so to speak, hard or soft. You know, we're having some difficulty with another, some tension. We stop for a few moments or two. We listen to what's going on inside of ourselves. And we pick up, well, there's a couple of voices going on here. Am I going to get aggressive back? Is the hard voice going to come out of me? And we might listen and say, oh, there's a softer voice in here. There's a kinder voice in here. And sometimes we listen and sometimes we say, whoa, the softer voice will be more effective, will be more important here. And that certainly does take a trust. So our exploration, listening to mindfulness and meditations, listening to the deep, listening as well to the experiences of others, and other women, men and children as well, really can offer us some inspiration. they can sometimes, what the children see about us is much clearer and honest than what we see about ourselves. My daughter's children said to my daughter, "Mum, you are a better mother as a single mother than when you've got a man in your life." My daughter went, "Yes, thank you for the feedback." And sometimes the kids know. Sometimes we've got to listen to the wisdom from the young and the old and those that are around us. And sometimes an insight, a few words of inspiration, we may be more receptive than what we realize. And that touches us, and that gives us some capacity to express our humanity as human beings, to listen to each other, to see sometimes in our conversations where there's plenty of appropriate place for chatter and all those things, and just sometimes a little bit of love and interest with each other, it can go to a deeper place. Quite naturally, and two people feel, "Wow, I just had over a lovely cappuccino, I just had a really lovely, lovely conversation, a real communication." And as the good Buddhist monk, after 19 years and 6 months in the forest, said to us, life is about relating. Thank you. Are there any few minutes, is all right?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So if there are any responses or any questions or anything to like to add or subtract, feel free. Yes, sir.
You said when some force comes from the deep,
yes,
and then you react.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain more? I can understand it as a topic, but I don't really understand.
Okay, all right.
The reaction. What do you mean by the reaction?
Response.
Yeah, the response rather than the reaction. In the course of a single day, of course. Here we are as human beings, we have our heart and our mind and our thoughts and our feelings and our attitudes and a whole dynamic of things which takes place. And bringing a little bit more interest and light and observation to that can be such that a small thing in the course of a single day stands out for us. There is some sense and feeling there's something significant. Whatever it might be. It might be an action which needs to be said or done. It might be an initiative which we need to start or to close or whatever. And that receptivity to the inner life, to all the expressions of it, including the mood and the states of mind and all of that, we're listening as well as we can to something deeper which touches us, sometimes very, very faintly, we hardly notice. But we see, we want to actualize it. We want that small thing or major to find some expression there. And there is a sense with this, it could be challenging, it could be a step into the unknown, it could be something creative, it could be something which needs to be shared and resolved, it could be a quiet commitment, and it's that in the being that we take the interest in. There may be other voices which try to corrupt it, and undermine it, and it's not worth it, what can you do, I can't do this, or whatever. All of that may come in there. And it might be, and is a challenge to stay true to something which one feels has a value in it, and generally speaking, it's of benefit to you and others. And this we want to be interested in. That's what I mean. Yes, please, yes.
Can you talk and explain a little bit more about the ethics?
Yeah. Yeah. So the request is, could I say a little bit more about ethics there? I think it's one of the areas of life which I deeply wish to see much more in the public discourse, ethics. And the most basic ethics is the relationship of ourselves to other, whoever the other might be. And the other will include, of course, other people, individuals and the collective. It will include animals and it will include the environment. It will include what's near and what's far, include one's neighbours here, one's neighbours not so far. And what is the ethic there? And that finding of the ethic in its most basic form is enough clarity and wisdom with life that we do not offer or express or reinforce that which is harmful. That is the primary base, to me, primary basic ethic. And therefore we're extremely vigilant about what we do, we're extremely vigilant about what we say, what we write, what our actions are, and we try to watch inside of ourselves any thought, the thoughts which have in it blame, fault-finding, negativity, anger, violence, and the rational thought which gives support to it. We really, you know, sometimes there's a monk in the hut, sometimes there'll be a snake in the hut. Sometimes in the rainforest where we were, sometimes one didn't know whether it was a rat snake or a cobra. And the quality of the mindfulness when one's sharing a small hut with a snake is remarkably high. I can tell you from first-hand experience there. It's the same kind of quality of mindfulness or awareness around harmful or exploitive thought. You know, to really to stay true to an ethic. It may be that other voices will tell us we are foolish, naive, idealistic, romantic, out of touch with reality, etc. Those who keep to a deep ethic will have to hear those voices. That one has to stay steady with. There is, even when there's an integrity around the relationship to others of non-harming, non-exploitation, it doesn't mean to say that ethics has then come to an end. It's just the beginning. It's kindergarten ethics, what I've just spoken about. It's just preliminary ethic there. Then the ethics then begin to come in about the whole lifestyle. Everything starts to then come into that. What we do, what we buy, what we eat, our relationship with money, our relationship with each other, our capacity to give and to share. All of that is in the field of the ethic. And we need the inspiration from each other, the insights from each other there, and there are people with deep ethical considerations. Just before coming here to Israel, 3 or 4 days before, I had a coffee with a friend, an Israeli friend. And she, in my world, she's in the world of the gods. I have. There are a few around, and she's one in the gods. So we were having a coffee in Totnes, where I live. And I know what she does, I know the work that she does. I said, what have you been doing in the past year? Oh, where have you been? And she works for an aid agency, giving support to refugees. She said, I spent the last year in Syria, Lebanon, Pakistan, Nigeria, India, working with refugees and people suffering from floods and wars and conflicts, etc. To me, that is a bold and ethic. And to stay true to it, and it's not, obviously, it's not without risk. It's high risk. And sometimes, as she pointed out in these years of doing this work, she said, sometimes the hunger of the families, so they arrive with the planes and they arrive with everything, and there is like a stampede of hungry people, you know, mothers and fathers, often desperate to feed their children. And there's a danger that it just runs riot and people will die and get trampled, etc. There's all these pressures which go on. I said to her, where did you get all the training from that allowed and enabled you to do this extraordinary work? And she said, through 10 years of dialogue and communication with the Palestinians. So in her training here and in her work here, gave the experience and the resources, and then when she went to the West, in this case to England, and said, this is what I've been doing, they said, can you join us? We need you. And sometimes the skills that we have, wherever the form may be, and the inspiration and the learning, then allows another step. And I think that quiet willingness in our life to for insight and to take steps into the unknown, there's a certain ethic which goes with that as well. It's the ethic in a way of staying true to something. In her case, staying true to love of humanity. That's what she does. She's quite remarkable. All credit to her family, her friends, her country here, and for all of that support which has allowed this woman to emerge so fully and to engage so fully in very challenging situations. It's a credit to all of you. Yes, sir.
I want to go back to the example of the snake in the hut.
The snake in the hut. Yeah, go on.
Because I think it's a little bit, I understand it's a little bit less ethical towards you because you...
A little bit, I'm sorry, I missed that
less
word.
Ethical. You because
less ethical towards you.
Less ethical towards me.
Because yeah. You put yourself in danger.
Oh, I see.
So what do you say about the borders?
Yes. So, if I understood the question, in the view of the snake in the hut, that it could be considered some lack of ethic on my part in whatever, say, taking the risk to be in the hut. What is my view? Well, as much as possible, mindfulness and peaceful coexistence, being mindful and learning to coexist. And it is quite extraordinary in the creature world, though sometimes we may have quite a lot of fear of, but creatures, they feel. Creatures know pleasure and pain. Creatures have extraordinary sensitivities there. One story, I'm sorry to repeat another monk story here, One of the monks went into a stream in northeast Thailand, not realizing that in that stream, in that river, there were crocodiles. And he went in there for what's called Ab Nam, for his bath. And then the crocodile glided straight towards him. And to his talk about equanimity. And the crocodile's nose was touching his stomach, the button, and the jaw was open. So his monk was a bit vulnerable in the other parts as well. And the monk just kept steady and calm and quietly speaking to this crocodile, probably on the lines, "Please do not bite." And the crocodile kept completely still. And he just kept quietly talking. And then the crocodile left, went away. Creatures, where there is love and fearlessness and kindness and steadiness, they can get a sense of it. Life is about relationship. One more question. Let's have a quiet minute together, shall we? Just for, a minute of stillness together, and then we'll finish. May all beings have a clear and wise relationship with themselves. May all beings have a clear and wise relationship with each other. May all beings live with love and wisdom. Thank you very much, everybody. I'd like to come and speak with you and just thank you.